The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. On June 12th, the House Judiciary Committee voted to approve H.R. 2851, the Stop the Importation and Trafficking of Synthetic Analogs Act of 2017, known by its acronym CITSA. CITSA is a bad piece of legislation that confers enormous power on the Attorney General in regard to drug control policy, as well as making the mistake of creating new mandatory minimum sentences. H.R. 2851 is a bad idea. It should have died in committee. It can still be stopped, but it will take a concerted effort. So to help us better understand the issues, here's Representative John Conyers explaining his opposition to H.R. 2851.
Members of the committee, this measure before us is intended to address the problem of illicit use of analog synthetic drugs. This bill involves important issues concerning public health and safety and also fairness in our criminal justice system. I appreciate the desire of many to protect our citizens from dangerous drugs, but this measure deserves much more careful examination. I recognize that analogs to some synthetic drugs are dangerous and are harming our citizens, especially young people. Some of these modified man-made substances are even more potent, more dangerous, and oftentimes more deadly than the substances that they are designed to mimic. However, in addressing these drugs, the dangers these drugs pose, I believe the Congress must be careful in advancing any legislative response. Unfortunately, H.R. 2851, although I am willing to concede is well-intended, it is ultimately unwise for several important reasons. To begin with, this measure would give the Attorney General almost unfettered authority over the regulation of these substances. While much of the conversation surrounding synthetic analogs focuses on the chemistry of the substances, from the process of manufacturing them to their effect on the human body, H.R. 2851 would eliminate vital scientific and medical evaluations normally undertaken by the Department of Health and Human Services and the Food and Drug Administration, and do away with binding recommendations provided by the Department of Health and Human Services in scheduling drugs. There are already statutory mechanisms in place to provide for the scheduling and regulation of new drugs that may be dangerous if misused. Those mechanisms require an appropriate degree of collaboration among the Justice Department, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Food and Drug Administration in scheduling synthetic analogs. This is because each of these agencies are equally important to the scheduling process. And under this bill, not only would the Attorney General hold the sole authority to schedule these substances, but he or she would also have the power to shape sentencing policy without the input of the United States Sentencing Commission that is currently studying the issue of synthetic drugs and penalties. We must be cautious in our response to synthetic drugs and heed the lessons we learned from the fear-driven legislation enacted in response to crack. For example, H.R. 2851 would establish lengthy and sometimes mandatory minimum penalties for certain offenses involving these analog drugs. We all know some of the problems that we've discovered dealing with mandatory minimums. Now, while mandatory minimum sentences give the appearance that we're taking strong action to address the problem, they are patently unjust as a matter of sentencing policy and are unnecessary to the imposition of appropriate sentences. That is the job of the Judiciary Committee. Indeed, extremely lengthy sentences are sometimes appropriately imposed by judges, but over-penalization through mandatory minimums is counterproductive and only contributes to our crisis of over-incarceration. Also, this bill has the potential to chill medical research into substances that may be beneficial or into alternative treatments for drug addiction itself. We must be careful not to harm innovation and exploration into the development of new drugs that can actually help us. And so in closing, I want to note that the committee has received a letter from more than 65 advocacy organizations opposing this bill, including among them the American Civil Liberties Union, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And furthermore, we just received a letter yesterday from a number of conservative groups opposing the bill as well. The signatories included Freedom Works, the American Conservative Union Foundation, and the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Please, we must not ignore their concerns as we consider approaching this issue through legislation. And so it's regretfully that I must oppose this bill and ask my colleagues from both sides of the aisle to examine it with extreme care. I thank the chairman, and I yield back the balance of my time.
That was Representative John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan, speaking before the House Judiciary Committee on June 12th. Representative Conyers was speaking in opposition to H.R. 2851. The bill passed on a voice vote shortly after. You're listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. A wide-ranging coalition of stakeholders is calling for an end to the practice of arresting people solely for drug use or possession. Earlier this week, the Drug Policy Alliance released a new report titled, It's Time for the U.S. to Decriminalize Drug Use and Possession. The report lays out a roadmap for how jurisdictions can move toward ending the criminalization of people who use drugs. This report was launched with a news teleconference that featured spokespeople from the DPA and several other supporting organizations. I was on the call along with Drug Truth Network Executive Director Dean Becker, so this week we're both bringing you highlights from that teleconference. Be sure to check out this week's edition of our sister program, Cultural Baggage, the flagship show of the Drug Truth Network, which is also available at drugtruth.net in order to catch more from this report launch. Today on Century of Lies, we're going to hear from Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, an organization better known as LEAP, and from Andrea Ritchie, who's an attorney, a researcher in residence at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, and a member of the Movement for Black Lives Policy Table.
Good afternoon, and thanks to DPA for the opportunity to participate in this call and for this report, which is really going to serve as a a valuable resource to our movements for liberation. As many listeners may know, last year a collective of 50 Black-led organizations, which make up the Movement for Black Lives, released a vision for Black Lives, which is a comprehensive policy platform setting forth a visionary agenda towards Black liberation. And the platform, which is available at policy.m4bl.org, has since been endorsed by over 300 organizations representing thousands of people in 40 different states. And the invest-divest plank of the Vision for Black Lives calls for investment in infrastructure, institutions, and programs that promote the education, health, and safety of Black people, and divestment from institutions, policies, and practices that harm Black communities. And so under this framework, the Movement for Black Lives has called for divestment from drug law enforcement. As previous speakers have indicated, drug laws have consistently served as vehicles for criminalizing Black people and communities, as tools of racial profiling, of discriminatory enforcement, of violence, extortion, abuse, and mass incarceration of Black people. And they've also been consistently used to deny us access to the things that our communities need to thrive and survive, including housing, employment, education, family, community, and entry and immigration status in the United States, while simultaneously failing to promote our health or safety or the needs of people who are struggling with addiction and survival. So in light of these realities, the Movement for Black Lives calls for retroactive decriminalization of drug offenses, immediate release and retroactive record expungement for all individuals convicted of drug offenses, and reparations for the devastating impact of the war on drugs on Black people and Black communities. Because, as highlighted in the platform, the Movement for Black Lives really understands the war on drugs to be a war on Black people and communities. As the DPA report highlights, Black people experience discriminatory impacts of drug law enforcement at every single stage of the criminal legal system, from stops to sentencing. And I wanted to just briefly add to the stats that are shared in the report and earlier in the call to highlight the impact of drug law enforcement on Black women, trans, and gender non-conforming people, and Black immigrants. Because as pointed out, despite equal rates of drug use across race, between 1986 and 1991, the number of Black women in state prison for drug offenses nationwide increased by 800%. And over the past three decades, there's been an over 700% increase in the number of women incarcerated in state and federal prisons, largely for drug offenses, making women the fastest growing prison population. And Black women continue to be incarcerated at twice the rate of white women. And this is a phenomenon that's continuing. Between 2010 and 2014, drug arrests increased by 9% for women, while they decreased by 7.5% for men. And similarly, you know, the population of women in local jails has increased 14-fold since 1970, and a third of those women are incarcerated for drug offenses, and almost half of women incarcerated in local jails for drug offenses are Black. And a significant percentage are mothers, which is what prompted the Movement for Black Lives to launch a national Mama's Day bailout action this year, securing the release of over 100 Black mothers nationwide. And as DPA has pointed out in other forums, you know, Black women also experience discriminatory drug law enforcement when pregnant and parenting, and are up to 10 times more likely to be reported to child welfare for drug use than white women, despite, again, equal rates of use across race. And finally, Black LGBTQ and gender nonconforming people are also targeted by the war on drugs. One national survey of trans folks found that based on widespread and deeply entrenched structural discrimination, employment, housing, health care, and all other aspects of life, half of Black trans respondents that had to sell drugs or sex at some point in their lives to survive, which places them at really high risk of drug law enforcement. And Black immigrants, similarly, are more likely to face deportation and exclusion based on drug law enforcement. So in light of these realities, the Movement for Black Lives wholeheartedly supports calls for drug decriminalization, emphasizes that it must be retroactive, and calls for the savings from decriminalization to be invested into reparations to all people who have been adversely impacted by the drug war, and used to meet needs identified by individuals impacted by the drug war themselves, including housing, employment, health services, harm reduction services, addiction support and treatment, but that all of these things need to be offered on a voluntary basis without mandating or coercing participation in services. and must also ensure that drug use and convictions no longer serve as a bar to entry in the U.S. or grounds for removal. So in light of those demands, we're really grateful to DPA for setting forth a roadmap to decriminalization and see that as a critical step towards promoting the health, safety, well-being, and liberation of Black people. So we're grateful to have been able to be here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I want to thank the DPA again for a great report as we continue to unravel this disastrous war on drugs here in the United States and beyond. Let me begin with saying that I'm going to do my best not to repeat what many of our prior speakers have already touched upon, for instance, dealing with racial disparity and discrimination and more. My focus will be pretty much dealing with police community relations as the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. This is what we are about. There is a huge focus on improving police community relations in this country, and right smack in the middle of it is this our policies regarding the war on drugs, drug prohibition. So let me just touch on something real quick regarding the report itself, where it mentions that U.S. law enforcement is making about 1.2 million arrests simply for drug possession every year. And it says on any given night, there are at least 133,000 people behind bars in our U.S. prisons and jails. We have 63,000 of them just being held for pretrial, haven't even been convicted yet, but they're incarcerated. You know, it's... I think it's time that we recognize that law enforcement should no longer, and when I say law enforcement, mainly the police, should no longer be the tip of the spear for solving what many believe to be a public health problem. That should be left up to our healthcare practitioners for those who are addicted, which is a very small population of those who actually use drugs. Let me give you just one quick example of what happens when you have policies such as this in play, and then the police are responding to these policies. You're giving their marching orders to do what they do in our neighborhoods and communities across the country. Let me point you to the recent Baltimore Police Department, Department of Justice investigation in its report, where they touched on over this roughly 4.5 year period with 300,000 questionable stops of mainly Black and brown citizens in Baltimore. Of the 300,000 plus stops during this particular period of time, only 3.7% of those stops resulted in a citation being issued or an arrest, some sort of formal enforcement action. What they then realized, you see, because they had surveyed data, the actual records of these stops, and we're talking paper, forms that were filled out. But what they realized is that this was not an accurate picture. Most of the stops were not being properly recorded. So they did a sampling of the radio transmissions and realized that that number is 7 times greater. So now we're really talking about 2.1 million questionable stops of citizens. Of citizens in Baltimore. But the number of documented stops, remember I mentioned 3.7, where we had some sort of form or documentation completed, remains the same. So that hard number, when you look at now 2.1 million stops, the real number or percentage of those stops is 0.5 where a ticket or an arrest was made. The reason I mention this is because one of these stops about, as we continue to peel back that onion in Baltimore City, we realize, as in any other city, these stops are about looking for drugs. Where strip searches are being conducted in the middle of our streets, in public view, cavity searches are being done of our Black and brown citizens. There is nothing today, there's not one single issue more important to deal with as we're talking about building relationships between police and community. There's not one more important topic than this. The end of decriminalization of those who possess drugs, those who use drugs, and get our police out of this, what many believe to be a health issue. And then there are many who believe that it's not truly a health issue because of the small percentage of people who are actually addicted. So, law enforcement has finally begun to see the light, but we still have a long way to go. We have programs such as law enforcement assisted diversion where we're not arresting people, we're not saddling them with a criminal charge, hence the conviction. We have police assisted addiction recovery initiatives, PERI, which started in New England in the state of Massachusetts, which is spreading across the country. But again, we're just scratching the surface. At the end of the day, we have to do what DPA and many of these other speakers are recommending, and that is to end the decriminalization of drug possession, drug use in this country. And I think we're going to do it. Let's continue to focus state by state and get it done. And again, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership is very happy to be a part of this effort. And thanks again to the DPA for this wonderful report.
That was Neil Franklin, a retired major with the Baltimore Police Department who's the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, and Andrea Ritchie, an attorney and researcher in residence at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, who is a member of the Movement for Black Lives policy table. I was able to get in a question during the teleconference. Now, it was a difficult question, not a softball. I believe in playing hardball even with friends and colleagues, because as a journalist, it's my job. And it's my responsibility to you, dear listener. I wanted to get that out of the way before we play the segment, and I also want to add that I think both Neil and Andrea, the two who responded to my question, knocked it clean out of the park. Here's that.
The racial and class bias, it shows itself not just in the drug war, of course. I mean, property offenses, violent offenses. Law enforcement's really good at bringing in the usual suspect, and the district attorneys are really good at getting a coerced guilty plea, but the question really has to be, how do we get past the usual suspects and start to address, and, you know, I mean, clearance rates for property crimes haven't cracked 20% yet. They crawled up a little bit during the Obama administration, but it's still fewer than one in five. Violent offenses, less than half. And God knows how many of those people are actually guilty of the crimes that they committed. So how do we get past the obsession and the usual suspects? How do we get past the race and class bias and get law enforcement from the district attorneys on down to the beat cops to start looking for the real perpetrators of crime?
So this is Neil. As far as, and I'll maybe I'm just touching part of this question, but as far as looking for the real perpetrators of crime, I think it's simple. In law enforcement, it's not as complicated as people think. It's basically about having policies that do not criminalize consensual adult behavior. Moral policing is another term that's used. So when people are hurting other people, and I think most of us know what that looks like, murder, rape, robbery, domestic violence, crimes against our children, human trafficking, and on and on. I think we know what they look like. I think that's where the police should be focused. I think as it relates to these other things, I think we should be talking about maybe administrative processes, even if that. But, and Gary McCarthy, who was the up in Chicago as the head of law enforcement up there, in a conversation I had with him one day, he says this to me. He says, someone sticks the gun in your face and demands your money, he says, I think we all can agree that that's a crime and something we, and, you know, crime we need to do something about, maybe involving the justice system and the police. He says, however, someone with eight packs of heroin in their hand, he says, I really don't know about that. He says, I really don't think that that's a crime. So again, it's about moving to a place of having policies that are about people hurting people. And that's where the police and our justice system comes in. And at the end of the day, we should continue to move towards restorative justice models in this country. And maybe it's not going to happen today or tomorrow, but believe it or not, after 34 years in law enforcement, I do believe that there is a possibility of even abolishing prisons in this country. That's just me.
This is Andrea Ritchie. I'm so excited to hear you say that, Neil. So appreciate your work across the board. I just want to sort of knock on some of the things that you were just saying in terms of also moving it a step back to prevention. And one of the key points of the Movement for Black Lives policy platform, the Vision for Black Lives, is really the need to invest in the things that communities need. When people commit property crimes, it's because they generally have needs or because of how we define property crimes to include basically being poor and living in public spaces through broken windows policing. So that's why we're calling for divestment from harmful policies that don't promote our public safety, like drug law enforcement, and calling for investment in the things our communities need that will then reduce people's need to engage in criminalized activities to just survive. So I also wanted to highlight another report that came out this week from the Law for Black Lives and the Black Youth Project 100, both of whom are part of the Movement for Black Lives, called Freedom to Thrive, Reimagining Safety and Security in Our Communities, that really kind of break down local budgets and budget analyses, including, I believe, but a number of cities, a dozen cities across the country, and sort of look at what we could be investing local funds in that would promote safety and prosperity in our communities, as opposed to investing ever more in policing, caging, and punishment that is proving to not actually promote safety and prosperity in our communities.
That was Andrea Ritchie there. She's a member of the Movement for Black Lives Policy Table. She was preceded by Neil Franklin, the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Be sure to check out this week's edition of our sister program, Cultural Baggage, which is also available at drugtruth.net, in order to catch more from this report launch. The Drug Policy Alliance's report, It's Time for the U.S. to Decriminalize Drug Use and Possession, is available at the DPA website at drugpolicy.org. All right, and now just enough time to remind folks about a couple of events that are coming up. In August, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of August is Seattle Hemp Fest. Once again happening up in Seattle along the waterfront. Details are available at the website hempfest.org. And then in October, it's the 2017 International Drug Policy Reform Conference hosted by the Drug Policy Alliance. It's October 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th in Atlanta, Georgia. More information about that at reformconference.org.
The point is, the good news is you legalized pot. You created a ripple effect. It's gone around the world. There's a change everywhere right now, and it's continuing. That's kind of part of the bad news, is that your job ain't over. It is way not over. You partly legalized marijuana. Congratulations. Now, there are a lot of problems. The racist nature of the laws, the reasons why this thing was created in the first place, why prohibition started. Awful, awful things. We've started to right a wrong. That's great. But you know what? The wrongs continue. You still have racial biases in the drug violations that you see happening around the city. There's a horrible racial bias in the way the criminal justice system is done. The police are good at catching the usual suspects.
And, well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. Executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programs are available via podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.